Right, we're continuing our series going through Luke's Gospel, what we follow, it's called. And the monitor isn't working, so I'll keep looking at the screen. Not because I'm trying not to look at you, but because otherwise I'll get lost in my own sermon. And that's never pretty, is it? When the speaker gets lost in his own message, so he doesn't know what he's talking about. Some of you are thinking, yeah, that happens more often than you realise, Eric. So we're looking at the next part of Luke's Gospel. And I want to start with this question. How good a driver are you? How good a driver are you? There's been lots of studies done about how good people are in driving. And sorry, it doesn't work. So they've tried. It doesn't work, yeah. So how good a driver are you? Lots of studies are done on that. And some of you might think, well, I'm more this sort of driver. Stick it in a lamppost or whatever. I've only crashed a couple of times in my driving career, and I don't think it was entirely my fault. It was a stupid place to put a lamppost, I thought. So it might be like that. Or you might think, no, actually, I'm this sort of driver, the open road, you know, and a flash car, just perfectly handle the car. I'm that sort of guy or girl, just really on it when I'm driving. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is bad and 10 is excellent, just think in your head, how would you rate your driving? What number would come to your mind? Okay, 1 is rubbish. You shouldn't be on the road. 10 is excellent. What sort of number comes into your head about where you would place yourself? Okay, you all thought of a number, have you? Put your hand up if you thought to yourself 7 or more. Put your hand up. If you thought 7 or more, yep, that usually happens. It's not a good sign because, 5 would be average because that's in the middle. So if you're saying 7 or more, you're definitely seeing yourself at the better end of the driving scale. And I see there's a real mix of genders there. It's not just cocky young guys who think they can drive well. There's a lot of cocky young gals who think they can drive well. The most common answer is actually 7. And, these two guys, Roy and Liersch, who are psychologists, did a massive study in driving where people were asked to assess themselves, then had a driving assessment, got the results of that, and were then asked to assess themselves again. And they came up with this thing called illusory superiority. Because it didn't matter how badly people did in the test, they still gave themselves a high number. So they go through the assessment and would get feedback like, your driving is rubbish. And they'd still say, oh yeah, I'm definitely 7, 7, 8, yeah, definitely that end of the scale. Completely blind to how bad a driver they actually were. And so if you gave yourself 7 or more, and if in your head you're thinking nearer 10, then you probably suffer with illusory superiority. That you think you're better than you actually are. Now, to get it wrong with driving is one thing. That means you may be a bit less patient on the road with other people's abilities and things like that. To get it wrong with this parable that Jesus taught is quite another. And illusory superiority in this parable is actually a very dangerous thing. Let's read the parable. Luke 8, verses 1 to 15. After this, Jesus travelled about from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, the manager of Herod's household. Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own means. While a large crowd was gathering and people were coming to Jesus from town after town, he told this parable. A farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path. It was trampled on and the birds ate it up. Some fell on rocky ground, and when it came up, the plants withered because they had no moisture. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up with it and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up and yielded a crop 100 times more than was sown. When he said this, he called out, "Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear." His disciples asked him what this parable meant. He said, "The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of God has been given to you, but to others I speak in parables, so that though seeing they may not see, though hearing they may not understand. This is the meaning of the parable. The seed is the word of God. Those along the path are the ones who hear, and then the devil comes and takes away the word from their hearts, so that they may not believe and be saved. Those on rocky ground are the ones who receive the word with joy, when they hear it, but they have no root. They believe for a while, but in the time of testing they fall away. The seed that fell among thorns stands for those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by life's worries, riches, and pleasures, and they do not mature. But the seed on good soil stands for those with a noble and good heart who hear the word, retain it, and by persevering, produce a crop. Now, if you've grown up in Christian circles, going to Sunday school or kids' church and church, or from a Christian family, you will know that parable really well. It's probably one of the first ones I ever remember learning in Sunday school, the parable of the sower. It's really a famous parable. And this is true for quite a lot of the Bible, if you're from a Christian home, that is the big danger. The big danger is over-familiarity and what I would call Sunday school interpretation. Not that there's anything wrong with kids' church, particularly the way we do it, but there's so often a sort of Sunday school level interpretation that we never move beyond. We just carry on thinking, oh yeah, I know what that means. And we dismiss it and miss the incredible significance and the challenge of this parable. So try as we look at it today, try to imagine you don't know it really well. If you do, if you're new here, that's great. You don't know it really well, so you can take it on board for the first time. But if you do know it and you're thinking, oh yeah, yeah, I know what he's going to say, then try to sort of put that out of your mind and let's look at the parable together. Because there's two big errors we can make when we hear that parable being read. And to some degree, they're subconscious. I'm not thinking that you'd consciously think these things, but subconsciously it'll be there and it will influence the way you then hear the parable. The two big errors we make. The first is that we assume we are obviously in the fourth group. Jesus describes four groups. Those who reject it straight away, those who can't cope with persecution, those who get distracted, and those who are going for it and spiritual and fruitful. And everyone I've ever spoken to who's a Christian just assumes they're in the fourth group. Well, obviously, Jesus meant I was in the fourth group. I'm not any of the others. I must be in the fourth group. Actually, that is illusory superiority. Thinking that about your driving, that's fine. Just don't hit my car. Thinking it about your spiritual state and being basically deluded about where you're at with God is a really worrying thing. The second thing is that we conclude the groups are fixed and there is no movement between them. So therefore, if there was a time when you were in the fourth group and you know you're really going for it spiritually and God was really doing things in your life and answering prayer, the danger is you think, oh, well, I was there, so I must still be there. Actually, that's not necessarily true. Soil conditions change. Plants change. Different things happen to plants. I'm not much of a gardener, but there's lots of evidence in my garden about what can happen as different plants spring up. And so try to have in mind those two things as we go through this. Do not assume you're in the fourth group. I actually doubt many of us are in the fourth group. And don't assume there's no movement between the two. It may be that you're not in the group you think you're in. But of course, that's also encouraging, because if you conclude this morning you're not in the group you feel you should be in, you can move. It's not fixed. You can move. Soil can be improved. Weeds can be got rid of. You can actually change. So we're in danger of getting it wrong and thinking too highly of ourselves. So the first group. This is where the seed lands on the hard path and the birds immediately snatch it away. Now, Jesus makes it very clear that this is a salvation issue. So this one wouldn't apply to someone who is really wanting to go on in their faith. This is talking about people who have simply rejected it out of hand. And Jesus is quite clear, they are in real trouble. Because their attitude is as hard as the path. Basically, they had set paths that the farmer would walk along to sow the seed, but also the path people would walk along so as not to damage his crops. And over the years, that path will become rock hard. Really pounded down very, very hard, and the seed simply can't penetrate it. The seed that lands on the path has no hope of penetrating into the ground. It's rock hard, and the birds simply come and eat it. And Jesus is warning that there are people, and maybe it's true of some of us here today, who are so hard against the Christian message that they don't even allow it the opportunity to be assessed. They don't even allow it to come in a little bit. They completely shut it out. And they're in real trouble, because it's actually very hard for them to even begin to engage with what it is that Jesus taught. It's very hard for them to begin to engage with what the message is about, because they're resisting it outright. They're not actually giving it any opportunity at all. What can we do? Well, prayer is vital, because it's very hard to get through to someone who's already decided they don't want whatever it is you have to offer. And I'm sure we can all think of people like that, not necessarily just with faith. You meet people in all sorts of areas of life who are like, no, don't want it. So absolutely dogmatic and just reject it. Sometimes I do door-to-door work. I meet people like this who just absolutely do not want to hear what the Christian message is about. And we need to be praying. If we are a Christian and we know people like that, prayer is really key, because we need God to be at work to soften their heart, as the Bible puts it, to help them to be more open to what it is that Jesus was teaching. The second group, the first group, I think, probably is less immediately applicable to most of us here. The second group. Now, this may well be some of us, and it may or may not be a salvation issue. So the first group, it's very obvious, and by salvation issue, I mean whether or not someone actually becomes a Christian or doesn't as a result of the process. So in the first group, it's very obvious. Those are people who haven't become Christians. They've rejected Jesus and what he taught. And this second group, they haven't rejected it, but they're finding it very difficult. And Jesus said that's because they've heard the message and they've liked what they've heard and they've responded to it. And then they've discovered not everyone is happy about that. And they've discovered they start to get a bit of persecution, a bit of challenge. Maybe family and friends aren't treating them the same way. Maybe they're starting to get the little sarcastic comments. They're starting to get left out of social things. And they're starting to realize that following this path has a price. So how on earth do you cope with that? Now, obviously, for us in the West, the persecution, if we can even call it that, is very, very minor compared to what would be happening to Christians in North Korea and Iran and places like that, where becoming a Christian literally carries the death penalty. When you're baptized as a Christian in North Korea or Iran, and you go under the water dying to your old life, that has a very powerful symbolism, because many of them know they actually may well die for their faith. None of us in the West are likely to die for our faith, but we will face, at times, persecution, isolation. People won't be pleased with what we say we believe, and they'll make life difficult for us. Maybe our lifestyle will have to change, and so people who shared that lifestyle with us in the past won't understand why it's changed, and they won't be happy. And they'll think we're being self-righteous or judgmental or dismissing the things that they value. And so there will be a price to pay. How do we begin to cope with that so that we don't come into this category of people that Jesus said fall away? They start off well, they're excited, they believe, then the criticism starts coming and they give up. I think it's two things. We need to firstly remember what it was that Jesus did for us. Paul says in, I think it's 1 or 2 Corinthians, that we are not our own. We were bought at a price. In other words, Jesus went through an incredible amount in order for us to be offered the chance of forgiveness and the chance of reconciliation to God. And when we reflect on everything he did on our behalf, the challenges that he calls on us to face seem really quite minor in comparison. And sometimes if you've been a Christian for a while, you can lose that sense of awareness of what it is that Jesus went through on our behalf. the suffering on the cross, not just the physical suffering, but the spiritual suffering as he bore the penalty of sin in himself so that we could be forgiven. And when we remember what he went through on our behalf, it becomes easier to accept that he then asks us in turn to be willing to face difficulty on his behalf. But I think also constantly reminding ourselves about the reality of the eternal. When you read some of the stuff that Christians who've experienced severe persecution write, that is always one of the things that sustains them. That awareness of the eternal. That this life is not all there is, and that one day they will be in the presence of God, the God that they've trusted and worshipped. They'll be in his presence. And they look forward to that. They long for that. And that enables them to cope with what is being thrown at them. So the first group aren't even Christians. They reject it. The second group believe. They're excited about it, but they back off when it looks like it's getting difficult. And the third group, and I've got quoted the actual verse here because I think this is the one that is most relevant for us where we're at today as a church. The seed that fell among the thorns stands for those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by life's worries, riches and pleasures, and they do not mature. I reckon that is probably most of us. Now, I know instinctively we tend to think, oh, no, we're definitely in the fourth group. Actually, I don't think that's true. The more I've thought about this over the last week, I think most of us are borderline third and fourth group, or actually completely in this group. And that's quite a scary realization, that we're perhaps not where we thought we were. You see, this is not a salvation issue. This is not a, do you get to heaven at the end of your life? Jesus isn't talking here about people who aren't proper Christians, who've never been really converted, who've never really come to faith. He's not talking about that. He's talking about people who are Christians. They know God. To use the Christian cliche, they are saved. But Jesus says that they do not mature. They don't actually become everything God intended them to become. They don't actually in this life become as Christ-like as God wanted them to be. And why is that? Well, because the weeds grow up around and choke them. And it's interesting that Jesus says it's choked by life's worries, riches and pleasures. So it's not just the people who've got lots of riches and pleasures. You might be thinking, oh, well, you see, I'm not going to be choked by riches and pleasures because I don't have any money and I don't enjoy much. So I'm not going to be choked by those because I'm poor and I'm miserable. So I'm okay, actually. I'm going to make it all the way to Christian maturity, poor and miserable. And that's great. But Jesus adds in that inconvenient other word, life's worries. So it's not just whether or not you're rich and having a great time or poor and miserable. It's also when you just worry about all those things and worry about life. In other words, when your focus shifts from who God is and what he's done for us to the things, the immediate things of this life and this world. Now, obviously, we're not here saying that Jesus is arguing for some sort of complete fatalistic attitude. We think, oh, I don't worry about anything. I don't put a seatbelt on, even though I gave myself a 3 on that driving thing. And I don't lock my doors. And, I don't worry whether or not the gas is lit when I turn it on. Because I just don't worry about anything. Now, Jesus is absolutely not meaning that. That would be to take it to a ridiculous extreme. But what he's talking about is when our focus becomes so obsessed with this life, so tied up with all the things about this life, about money or the lack of it, about enjoying ourselves or not. Because sometimes that can be worse. To not be enjoying yourself and being convinced everybody else is even more of a distraction from God than enjoying yourself. And we allow all these things to come in. And Jesus said they choke our spiritual life. And one of the problems is that and I say this as an expert gardener, is that weeds can sometimes be a bit difficult to identify. When I go into my garden, I sort of battle through sort of elephants and other things in there. It's sort of a bit overgrown. And you confront these plants, I don't actually always know whether they're a weed or not. It's not always easy to tell. They're green, and they've got flowers. And so I think, oh, that's nice, that's a flower. And then someone else comes and says, oh, it's a weed. But I think it looks very nice. But you can't always tell. Some weeds do look attractive. And you might let them grow because they look attractive. And then, of course, they choke the plant that you're trying to grow. Not that I'm particularly trying to grow any in my garden, but were I trying to, that would be really annoying. I think we need to understand that. Weeds can seem attractive, but they choke the life out of the plant that you're wanting to grow. They absorb, I mean, particularly this time of year, not much rain. If you've got lots of weeds, they will suck up all the water. There won't be the water for the plants you're trying to grow. And if all our emotional energy goes on to riches, pleasure, or worrying about riches and pleasure, then we won't have the emotional energy to really find God in the way that we should. And what will happen? We don't lose our salvation, but we fail to mature. We become so focused on the things of this life that we lose sight of what God created us to be. And that's tragic. That is absolutely tragic. That we allow ourselves to be so diverted by everything else that we fail to become what we were created to be. The God who created the universe created each of us to fulfill a purpose. And yet we turn aside from that to amuse ourselves with the junk that our culture offers us. A.W. Tozer said, "The things you think about when you're not particularly thinking about anything show where your priorities lie." The things you think about when you're not particularly thinking about anything show where your priorities lie. What do you think about in those quiet moments? Are you thinking about money and success and your new car, your holiday, all those sorts of things? Or are you thinking about, I wonder how God will use me today? Do you drive to work thinking, I hope God really uses me today? Or do you drive to work either worrying about work or hoping you'll do well and sort of succeed at work? Now, the Bible is not anti-success. Let's be clear on that. The Bible is not anti us flourishing in any area of our lives. But it is very definitely anti us making idols of those things and thinking that they will do for us what only God can do. Because it cheapens God to even begin to liken him to the things that we think are so important. So that's the danger. The danger is that we are being choked and we don't necessarily realize it. The final group. Jesus said, "But the seed on good soil stands for those with a noble and good heart who hear the word, retain it, and by persevering produce a crop." But what does that look like? You might be thinking, well, you know, Eric, as you're talking this morning, I'm not sure which group I'm in. I'm not sure if I'm being choked or if I'm fruitful. What does being fruitful look like? What would a fruitful Christian look like? How would we distinguish between someone who is beginning to be overwhelmed by riches, pleasures and worries and someone who's being fruitful? What are the things, what are the indicators? Well, I think firstly, we should be looking for spiritual fruit. And the Bible describes spiritual fruit in different ways. It describes them as temperamental spiritual fruit. Love, joy, peace, gentleness, kindness, meekness, self-control. A sort of temperamental spiritual fruit. So that's one thing we should be looking for in ourselves. Not in other people. Do not immediately think how this sermon applies to other people that you can see around you. I'm glad so-and-so's here. They really needed to hear this. They could do with a little bit of love, joy, peace in their life. Let's not do that. For yourself, do you see the temperamental spiritual fruit? Are you loving, joyful, peaceful, seeking to live at peace with everyone, exhibiting self-control? That's the temperamental spiritual fruit. And then the other spiritual fruit would be in terms of the way we live our lives. Are you generous? If God has blessed you, are you known to be generous? Someone who gives sacrificially? Are you known to be someone who's willing to serve? Doesn't matter what it is, you're willing to be the one who's there doing the jobs that need to be done. Are you willing to be the one, or are you known to be the one who, as Jesus puts it, goes the second mile? Make an effort for people, an effort to help them, an effort to support them, to care for them, to reach out to them. Or do you see yourself as a bit above that sort of thing? So there's those two areas. There's temperamental spiritual fruit, love, joy, peace, gentleness, kindness, meekness, self-control. And then there's the outworked spiritual fruit. Are you generous and sacrificial with your money, with your service, with your time, with your care? Then another sort of spiritual fruit is that if we're really being used by God, there should be an expectation that we'll be seeing others come to faith. Now, this does vary a little bit with gifting. I'm aware that as an evangelist, I'm called and gifted to do evangelism, therefore I'm more likely to see people come to faith than someone who isn't. But all of us should be looking for that spiritual fruit, that we will be able to share our faith and to live out our faith in such a way that other people will be drawn to it and excited by it. And maybe that's where you used to be. You see, maybe you're looking at all this or listening to all this morning, you're thinking, you know what, that's where I used to be. I used to be like that. I know my faith used to be really real. I know that God was really real and prayer was exciting. And when we got into times of worship, it was incredible. I really knew God's presence. That's where I used to be. But you know, it's not true now. And can I just say that doesn't have to be a long-term decline. When I look at my own life, I've actually gone into quite accelerated periods of spiritual decline. I'd like to be able to say, oh, it took at least 10 years for me to really lose the plot spiritually. Actually, 10 minutes would be closer. I can think of times when something has happened, I've reacted badly to it, and I've lost the plot spiritually quite quickly. Don't think, oh, well, I'm much younger than Eric, this wouldn't have happened to me yet. It can happen to any of us in a scarily short period of time. That we move from that fourth group, being fruitful, going for it with God, to being strangled by the things of this life. Our focus shifts, we become obsessed with what this world can offer us, and we've dropped down a group before we even noticed it had happened. Hopefully, this fourth group is where you want to be. Maybe you're fairly new to the Christian faith today. You're thinking, I really want to be in that group, but I don't think I've got there yet. That's great. God will honour that. Or maybe you're thinking, I used to be in that group. I want to be back there. That's really great as well. If you're thinking this morning, I don't really care, then really you need to get that sorted. You really need people to be praying for you. You really need to engage, because that would be a very dangerous place to be. So if we want to be in that final group, or want to be sure we're in that final group, how do we get there? I think the thing we need to ask ourselves is, where is our focus? You see, worries, riches and pleasures seem real until God is once again central in our lives. And when God is central, and when we're enjoying God, when we're knowing God better, when we're growing in our faith, these things begin to lose their interest. I really don't want you to see, as Jonathan was doing with the children earlier, I don't want you to go away from today thinking this is all about gritting your teeth, being as miserable as anything, and forcing yourself to go to rubbishy prayer meetings that you don't want to be at, but you've got to do it or else Eric will think you're in the third group. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is setting aside time and focus to develop and grow a picture and knowledge and understanding of God such that the rest becomes really quite easy. Because our love for that will replace our love for other things. When I was a child growing up, I was sort of not really into any particular sport when I was younger. I wasn't myself very sporty. I know, looking at me now, you'd think surely you were an athlete's figure if ever we saw one. But I wasn't particularly sporty. And most of my time was spent doing a thing called dump digging, which is where you'd find an old Victorian rubbish dump and dig in it to find things. And I thought it was absolutely great. Me and my little group of friends, we were all into collecting Victorian bottles, which apparently wasn't a particularly trendy thing to do. And that is how we'd spend our time. And it was absolutely great. And if someone found a new dump, we'd all be, you know, cycling over there with our spades and digging away and having an absolutely great time. I was a completely normal child. I just want to emphasize that. That is what the cool kids did, I reckoned. Now, you didn't need to try and persuade me. You didn't need to say to me, oh, you know, you've got to really, the new dump we found, it's quite a long way away and it's the top of a hill, you have to cycle up a hill, it's going to be hard. You really don't want to, yeah, it's going to be hard, you have to grit your teeth. I'd be like, no, that's great. And I'd be sort of cycling manically to get there to find my, you know, those stone ginger beer bottles. Are you all into Victorian bottles? You know what I'm even talking about? No? Some of you don't. Oh dear. Well, the sort of the dream ones was Cod's Lemonade with a little marble in. And so if you found one of those, it'd be brilliant. Make your day. And all the effort of cycling there and digging through, I tried not to think about what we were digging through, because it was a rubbish dump, in order to get that, made it very worthwhile. And that's the approach I want us to have to this. Not necessarily bottle digging. I can see that's a minority interest by the bemused expressions. But it's that thing of what I am seeking is so much better than what I had, that I'm willing to pay the price to get there in order to have it. And that's the approach I want us to have. What we are seeking is so much better than what we have that we're willing to pay the price to make the effort to get there, to find more of God, to know more of God, to experience more of God. And when we do that, to be honest, the latest sort of, 4K flat screen telly fitted inside our car so we can watch telly while we drive because we're such a good driver will really seem quite insignificant in comparison. The more we focus on Him, the less the riches, pleasures and worries of this life will choke us. But that's a choice we have to make. God does not force this on us. God doesn't make this happen. I wish it'd be a lot easier if He did, if I could just sort of click my fingers and be instantly totally spiritual. But that's not how God works. He wants us to want Him. He wants us to want to know Him and experience Him. And if we do that, if we start that journey, then the hold of the weeds around us will be broken and we will be fruitful and God will be real to us. Should we pray? Lord, forgive us for our complacency that we just assume we're okay spiritually when there's often so little evidence for it. Forgive us, Lord, for the times, and I so much include myself, Lord, for the times when I have prioritized other things over You, or I've worried about other things instead of trusting You. Help us, Lord, to grow in that devotion to You, that knowledge of You, that experience of You, so that we really do get our priorities right. Forgive us when You've entrusted things to us and we've kept them for ourselves instead of being generous. Forgive us for the times when we've not served because we were distracted by other things. Forgive us most of all, Lord, for not truly understanding who You are and why You are so much more valuable than anything this world can give. Amen.